My name is Michael McCusker. I'd like to say happy birthday this Groundhog Day to my friend Vicky Ott, aka V-Lot, and my term of endearment for her, the divine Ms. V. And also happy birthday to Will Violet, who is 21 today. Well, I'd like to read something that I wrote, so I should probably give my disclaimer that this is my opinion and perhaps my opinion only in the entire cosmos. Newt Gingrich's defeat in the Florida Republican presidential primary election earlier this week does not seem to have deterred him. He vows to battle for the presidential nomination to the very end. His motto at present, is 46 more states. So far, he has won one primary out of four. He placed second in Florida. I wrote a satire about Newt for my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, in 1995, during a period when I was happily writing sardonic spoofs about prominent political figures who, in my little stories, were visiting Astoria, and I staged them in the mythical Top of the Astor Lounge that was misguidedly never envisaged atop the real John Jacob Astor Hotel when it was structurally preserved and remodeled in 1985. The contractors said that it would be too expensive to get plumbing up to the top floor or enough plumbing for a restaurant and a lounge. But even the people working on it knew that's where it should be, atop of the Astor. So I guess to save a buck, 26 or some odd years later, they could have made millions of dollars. And in this little piece that I'm going to read, the quotes attributed to Newt are actually straight out of his mouth at the time and will positively show that he hasn't changed his focus very much these past 17 years. As today is Groundhog Day, it seems fitting to look for Newt's shadow. And that is the title, The World According to Newt. And by me, Michael Paul McCusker. I am standing at my usual place at the bar of Astoria's premier night spot, the Top of the Astor, overdosing my liver with an inexpensive poison I call Red Death, when this pompous guy with uptight silver hair walks in with three very predatory-looking persons. He leads them to a table in a corner next to windows that look out over the city's waterfront and the Columbia River. I see clouds outside the windows rise out of the ocean and spread across the sky like a sheet pulled over a corpse. My friend Rita takes their orders. "You know who those people are?" I ask her when she comes to the bar. She looks at me wearily. "Yeah, I know who they are," she says. "Buttheads." "Newt Gingrich and three stooges from Salem," I say. "Clairno, Durfler, and Tiernan. The new breed of Wild West suburban Republicans. Tom McCall would despise them." Rita looks over at the table. "Like I said," she says, "Beavis and Buttheads." She loads drinks on a tray and takes them to Newt's table. I slide down the bar so I can listen. I am curious why Newt Gingrich, the most powerful speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives since Uncle Joe Cannon's grim and reactionary reign during the first Roosevelt, is in Astoria, far away from Beltway celebrity and mainstream media. I am quickly answered. Newt jabbers while Clairno, Durfler, and Tiernan lean eagerly toward him like a football huddle. He is ecstatic that the legislature has successfully fabricated what he says is a contract with Oregon, which he says over and over again like a mantra. He praises the reinvention of private property and the hoped-for demolition of Oregon's once pioneering land use laws. He is a cheerleader for clear-cutting, the last public forests and abolishing endangered species laws. The same for clean air and pure water regulations, which interfere with the economic benefits of pollution and sewage. He raises Rita's thermostat when he greets the obsequious top of the Astor manager with boisterous support for applying waitress tips to any pay raise, an idea cooked up by the state's restaurant owners. "I don't get paid anything because my tips are taxed more than I get," Rita says to me. "Now Newt and my boss want the tips I don't get to be the raise they're never going to give me." Newt looks at Rita like she doesn't exist when she goes back to the table with change. She returns to the bar with an empty tray. Stiffed. "They're treating me like a slave," Rita says. "Of course they are," I say. "They are demonstrating their superiority over you after reducing you to poverty." She looks at me sourly. "You don't get it," she says. "These are bite mothers, nurturing breast kind of people. It's got nothing to do with politics." "Everything's got to do with politics," I say. Rita shakes her head. "Their whole way of looking at life is because they think they didn't get enough tit when they were babies," she says. Newt congratulates the three Oregon legislators for their loyalty to the Republican banner throughout the 1995 session of the state legislature, which the GOP has, for the first time in 40 years, packed both houses. He likens it to the Republican-dominated 104th Congress's breakneck and breakheads tempo its first 100 days to pass his ambitious and hard-hearted contract with America, which critics liken to a mafia contract. He praises Tiernan's merciless attack on public workers and Durfler's aggressive efforts to peel back the state's land use laws. He is more restrained and less specific when he compliments Clarno, a woman, for upholding the contract with Oregon in her status as Speaker of the State House of Representatives. "A contract with Oregon is a contract with America," Newt says, "and vice versa," Tiernan interrupts excitedly. Newt implores his passionately avaricious toadies to carry the contract's banner beyond the legislative session. "You can't go home and rest on your laurels," he tells them. "The contract must be implemented everywhere, carried to every farm and suburb. We must reassert American civilization because we have to lead the human race," Newt says. We need a new American journey. We need a quest into the future." I stare at Newt's reflection in a large mirror back of the bar. I can't focus on him. He is jerky and irrepressible, a distinct type of American character, both appealing and repellent, an ideologue graced with a little learning and the power to use it. His speech is larded with hyperbole and space babble. Jerry Brown of the right, some call him, only farther out in space. Neuter Moonbeam. Andy Rooney, plated over Power Rangers. Boris Yeltsin, Southern Fried. People who know him say Newt is concerned about humanity, but has a hard time relating to human beings, which they really mean he is a control freak. He promotes himself as vigorously as if he is a car or a house he is selling. "Government must be returned to the people," Newt says. "To you state legislators, to mayors and city councils. That's what the contract with Oregon means. Power to the people," Clarno, Durfler, and Tiernan say in unison, almost as an amen. "The government is out of control and out of date," Newt says. "It is obsolete and backward-thinking and needs dynamic change. Our modern leaders have forgotten that government cannot substitute for private initiative, personal responsibility, or faith." He says the country needs a new modern dialogue, an American people's plan, a new birth of American freedom, which sound like 12-step programs. Newt blames welfare for America's malaise. "Welfare fosters anti-work, anti-family, and anti-property," he says. "We must replace the welfare state with the opportunity society and the world market state," he says. Newt blows bromides like bubbles. "Work over laziness," he says. "Savings over debt. Family over individual chaos." He says the Democratic Party despises the values of the American people and indulges in multicultural hedonism that is inherently destructive of a healthy society. Republicans are the real Americans, Newt says, the normal Americans. We are the party of Main Street, not Wall Street, he says disingenuously and rather unbelievably. There may be a Republican epic, but it is not a romantic myth, he rhapsodizes. It's more about people coming together on a wagon train and how hard it was going west. At the end of this period, people will say, I was on the wagon train that dramatically changed the country. I almost knock over my glass of Red Death at Newt's blather, but the New Oregon pioneers stare at him in rapture. We are the new revolutionaries, Newt says. We aren't going to replace the social engineering of the left with social engineering of the right. A new civilization is merging in our lives, and blind men everywhere are trying to suppress it. Clairno, Derfler, and Tiernan nod and look serious. The enemies of democracy are within its body like a cancer. That's what Jefferson said, Newt says. Cancer and calumny eat away at democracy from within. Sounds more like Joe McCarthy. Anybody can use Jefferson, which Newt does again almost immediately. When Jefferson said, every generation needs a revolution, he wasn't making an argument for chaos, Newt says. He was making an argument for the creative replacement of the old order with a new order. If all you are is a revolutionary with no sense of order, you're just a bandit. But Newt twists Jefferson. Old Tom's intent was to replace a repressive and corrupt colonial government with a truly revolutionary guarantee of power to the people. Newt's purpose is to return America to the vertically organized and patronage-dominated 18th century that the American and French revolutions blew asunder. Newt's America runs especially counter to Thomas Paine's America, which is a vision of a decent and happy life for ordinary people who are rulers rather than ruled. Newt wants to reestablish an old order of privilege and power based on wealth and property, which currently dominates but does not yet entirely rule the country. Politics means allowing somebody to dominate your life, Newt says, reversing Jefferson and Paine. I think of Juvenal, writing of old Rome's political gangs. Quote, yesterday they were ruffians. Today they rule over our lives. Tomorrow they will be keepers of the lavatories. Unquote. In old Rome, Newt would have been a leader of a political street gang that beat opponents to death and burned their houses down. He tortures our national house and acts like the Caesar of his reconstruction. I wonder if he regards himself as F. Scott Fitzgerald's model of a first-rate intellect, who is able to see that things are hopeless and yet be determined to make them otherwise. More likely, his zealously superficial brain realizes the public despair is his ticket to omnipotence. I am dazzled by an epiphany. The eye of Newt is upon the presidency. What else would be his grail? His entire political course has been a Mein Kampf toward his greater future as American Führer. I suddenly realize Newt is not the advocate for Congress he pretends to be. Congress is his power lift to the presidency. He must be president to force his contract upon America. He has to saddle the whirlwind he blew up or lose the momentum he created. The so-called Republican Revolution he orchestrates is a deceptive restaging of Gilded Age hog feeding. He manipulates for residency in the White House. Newt echoes Ivan Bosky, greed is good. Newt is a populist demagogue pundits and doom and gloomers are always warning about. An obsessively ambitious and clever imposter who operates on the fringe of fear and loathing. He exploits the disruption and apprehension usually frequent at fin de siècle, but at the end of the 20th century is also the start of a millennium which can't help but spring out old hysterias and superstitions. Gingrich Kahn emerges from the shadowed plateau of our dread. Newt made his bones as the Republicans' chief assassin in Congress. He scorns even an appearance of benevolence and wears his black hat proudly. "I am an American Gaullist," he says. De Gaulle restored France. His faith was in nationalism and technology. But de Gaulle was a royalist who thought only he could save France, and he also believed its worst enemies were some of its citizens. Newt's eyes lock onto mine in the bar mirror. He looks like somebody who won't be a friend. His eyes flicker away almost immediately. I feel dismissed as being no use to his ambition. He probably guesses I'm an old hippie, a tiny cell of the social cancer he wishes to wipe away like scum off a glass slide. I have worked for bosses like him. You don't exist to them except when useful or perceived a threat. "Relate to me," I snarl at Newt in the mirror. "Tell me about the malignancy within. Say it loudly. True Americans must eradicate untrue Americans. Tell me that society has to be ethnically cleansed of persons you call abnormal Americans, who are presumably people like me who are to the left of Adela the Hun, uppity pushy women who frighten the testicles off white males, non-Christians and aliens who are everyone of color, no matter how many centuries their ancestors have lived here, even those who greeted Columbus and assisted Lewis and Clark. Convince me I owe my life and labor to a plutocracy that enriches itself by impoverishing the rest of us," I shout silently at Newt's mirror face. "Inspire me that a great America depends on removing inferiors and undesirables who must be given the chance to die of their own weakness by abolishing every opportunity for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." I think of something a woman suggested to me. "Hey, Newt," I smirk at his reflection, "what if in vitro testing not only determined a person's sex, but also its sexual preference? Would your pro-life homophobic friends propose abortion for homosexual fetuses?" Newt's reflected mouth moves as relentlessly as a drum-beating rabbit in a battery commercial. "Our goal is simple," Newt says, "to train 200,000 citizens as a model for replacing the welfare state and reforming government." I get the chills and gasp at his audacity. Newt is proposing to raise a private army election year, a rabble of true believers recruited to make domestic politics as severe and confrontational as the Cold War with Communist Russia. No mercy for the other side or anyone who resists the new kingfish, Huey Long reincarnate. "Politics and war are remarkably similar systems," Newt says, almost reading my mind. "We are a happy bunch of Vikings who don't mind a fight." Newt's brand of Americanism makes me think of an old cartoon poster of Nixon and Agnew, who are unshaved cooks in a gag-and-barf cafe. Nixon shoves a plate of red, white, and blue spaghetti with stars for meatballs at the Observer. "Shut up and eat it," he snarls. I wonder if Newt's loyal core, whom he intimidates into obedience, realize that their narrow and flogging perception of democracy disrupts the majority they claim to represent. Yet their claim might be real. That has always been the problem with majority rule. A majority is easily bluffed into to bully. Laceration of deep inferiority feelings works almost every time. People react with fear and loathing, usually against minorities. The irony is that it is usually minorities who strive for liberty and justice, just as it is a minority that craves raw power and will do anything to get and keep it. The bartender refills my Red Death. "Waste of time listening to those peckerheads," he says. He looks grimly at Newt's table. "Maybe being a liberal isn't so popular nowadays," he says, "but at least we got larger alimentary canals than rednecks, and don't keep all that bleep bottled up." Newt explains capitalism to his eagerly capitalistic listeners. "The capitalist system gives everyone the opportunity to move up and achieve," he says. "We should look at it that everyone has an opportunity to achieve, but not necessarily accomplish equal results. Some become more equal than others, accumulating more than equal property, wealth, and power, which of course shrinks the equality of the rest. Newt thinks that's the way it should be, natural selection. Social Darwinism is a fact, he says. He follows this disingenuous alliteration to Adam Smith with a gem of doublethink. The engine that pulls the train must continue to be fueled, he says. He spells it out. Tax breaks for low-income people must be sacrificed for high-income tax breaks. Affluent taxpayers must receive breaks because they invest money and create jobs for others, Newt says. I sneer at Newt's bald-faced image in the mirror. Those affluent taxpayers don't invest in anything except their own stock portfolios, and they not only don't pay their fair share of taxes, they gorge on public money, which people like Newt call welfare when distributed among the poor, and investment when extorted by the rich. At the same time, Republicans cut off welfare to unwed teenage mothers and downsized workers. They initiate special tax breaks to favored corporations that amount to billions of dollars. They cut the taxes of big business and the rich and spoil them with billions more in subsidies they claim are essential to the free market, which is regarded as a natural force. Public services and poverty programs are gutted to make up the shortfall. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. That is Republican tax policy and the taproot of its counterfeit revolution, Newt's crown jewel. Maybe Newt and his gang should be allowed to rule without protest or resistance in the interests of the nation's new Tories and roll back the hard-won laws and principles of two centuries. Ordinary people might realize what they have to lose and take back what they've lost, which should sober up the next couple of generations. But maybe no one will be inclined to retrieve rights our forebears knew were essential to liberty and equality. Maybe democracy didn't win the Cold War after all. Old coarse fascism in modern populist disguise has triumphed. Hothouse capitalism exists best in strictly controlled environments in which social classes are rigidly defined and no one is allowed to question or reform the arthritic incompetence and desolation such corrupt and moribund mediocrities usually foster and perpetuate like fetid molds. You try to confuse us, I say to Mirror Newt. You claim corporate capitalism is free market Americanism. You try to convince us that big business willingly and enthusiastically competes for sheer love of competition in an unfettered emporium of commerce. I laugh harshly at Newt's facile face and drink a long swallow of red death. Tell me you actually think the ruthless takeover wars that eliminate thousands of jobs are essential to your almighty free market, I snarl silently. Are you going to lie and say you don't suspect that corporations are inherently socialist rather than capitalist, and that their bitter competition to dominate the American economy is winner-take-all? Hey, Newt, I say, leaning across the bar at the mirror, this is a war between the robbers and the robbed, and you, you old draft dodger, you're the robber warlord. One of the regulars slops against me at the bar. He looks over at Newt. I know that guy, he says. Oliver Cromwell. No, that guy Donahue. Newt gets spacey as the drinks flow. He touts a virtual world, simulated, distracted from the real world. Instead of cake, as suggested by Marie Antoinette, Newt wants the common folk to feed on sugar frosting. We can develop American populism in space in the beginning of citizen involvement by initiating a tourism program for the American people, he says, and blames the welfare state for the decision not to move more quickly into space. If you think about the notion that the great challenge of our lifetime is first to imagine a future that is worth spending our lives getting to, Newt says, and then, because of the technologies and capabilities we have today, to get it up to sort of a virtual state, although that's done in your mind, what did he say? I find it fascinating that we are not in a new place, Newt says. It's just becoming harder and harder and harder to avoid the place where we are. Newt is lost in space babble. He rants about factories and jobs in space, a honeymoon on the moon, and a host of high-tech efforts to spread a new electronic gospel. Moonbeamy, technoholic, Newt is future drunk, technomania in eternal combat with technophobia. He foresees intense rivalry in the near future as a result of overpopulation and depletion of resources as his grand opportunity. He is staking out the pennant of the rich and famous as his very own mainspring to absolute power. You're making sure your rich patrons get through the millennium by sacrificing the rest of us, all for yourselves and nothing for anybody else, I mumble aloud to Newt's somewhat blurred virtual face in the mirror. You and your gang are stripping away everything that counts, even clean air, clean water, and the last forests. You're giving everything back to the big polluters and the rape and pillagers and make it virtually impossible for prevention like litigation or lawsuits for public or personal damages. You say you're a futurist, but you act as crazy as Watt, who said environmentalism was unnecessary because God was going to terminate the planet any minute. A crowd comes in and quickly fills the top of the Astor. Rush Limbaugh sits at a table with Pat Robertson and Robert Dole. Ralph Reed and several crystalliticians take a large table. Pat Buchanan sits by himself. Tattooed skinheads in cut-off leathers and swastika emblems maraud in at the bar. A large group of beer-gut commandos in military camouflage, armed with NRA-approved assault rifles, marches in. Mark Hemphill, who damn near single-handedly bought this year's legislature, surrounds Newt with his Oregon business roundtable. Newt raises his glass in salute. Money is the mother's milk of politics, the Speaker of the House says cheerfully. Clarno, Durfler, and Tiernan lick Newt's shoes while he sings, "The morning will come when the world will be mine. Tomorrow belongs to me." I recognize it from Cabaret, an angelic Nazi boy singing in a beer garden. Rita squirms through the crowd to Newt's table. She bends to pick up empty glasses and full ashtrays. Tiernan laughs and pinches her fanny. She smacks the tray against his head, which disappears in an explosion of ashes and shards of glass. I see it all in the bar mirror and rush over to the table, prepared to say anything and everything on my mind. I splash red death in Newt's face like Jose Ferrar did to Fred McMurray in Caine Mutiny. "You slimy reptile," I say. The Republican majority of the Oregon legislature appear from everywhere in the restaurant and bar. I am engulfed. Hands grasp me, lift me off the floor, and throw me through an open window next to the table. As I fall 8 floors from the top of the Astor to the street, I see anchored oil ships staining a toxinated river, empty of salmon and sea lions, the city's scalp skinned of trees, smoke pumping into the ozone and sewage into the river from fully computerized paper mills and aluminum plants wall to wall on the waterfront, vacant, shabby, or burnt shells of old houses falling down the hills. Downtown is desolate, boarded up. Out-of-work Astorians fight each other for scarce food stamps or squat along curbs, smoking dung or drinking urine. Wolf packs of homeless children roam through the city. Newt's America. I hit the sidewalk and wake up. And that is a satire and diatribe that I wrote several years ago, back in 1995. And as I said earlier, most of these quotes attributed to Newt Gingrich are from his own mouth. And so perhaps we might have found his shadow. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.